from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Next week, Tony Blair marks his 8th anniversary as Prime Minister of Great Britain. The glorious wave of good feeling of a new dawn breaking in British society is gone. Trouble in Iraq, dissension in the parliamentary ranks in London, and slipping popularity even among his most ardent supporters have left Blair watchers wondering, is this the beginning of the end for the British Prime Minister? Tonight, On Point, the tragedy of Tony Blair. But first, news from Iraq. A new USA Today CNN Gallup poll shows a majority of Iraqis believe that the U.S. occupation has done them more harm than good, and that they support an immediate withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. Quite a change from an ABC News BBC poll released 6 weeks ago that claimed almost 70% of Iraqis felt their lives had improved in the year since the war began. Richard Burkholder is International Bureau Chief at the Gallup poll, and I asked him to describe the key findings in these new surveys.
The biggest finding, I think, on a personal level, most people still think it was worth anything they've gone through to have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, but that's all in the rearview mirror now. And so now they're looking with some trepidation towards the future. They're optimistic for about 5 years out from now, but I would have to say that the performance of the coalition thus far in bringing security, reconstruction, even democracy and elections has all been a disappointment.
When were the polls conducted?
We did them starting in March 22nd up to almost all of them were finished by April 2nd. A few stretched out for another week or so.
You got out just before the fire started. April 2nd, I think, was the day after the four civilian contractors were killed in Fallujah.
Exactly.
And then over that weekend, the U.S. picked a fight with Muqtada al-Sadr, which is still going on.
Absolutely right.
So do you worry that some of these findings are actually already badly dated?
No, I'll tell you why I think the timing's fortuitous. First of all, we caught certainly in Anbar province, which is where Fallujah and Ramadi are, in Saladin, which is Tikrit, we caught the anger there. It was boiling already, even before that. For instance, I think we only have 13% of Iraqis nationwide who say they think it's completely justified to attack U.S. forces. But in those two provinces, and what the press actually refer to as the Sunni Triangle, it's 62%. Now, that's before that explosion. You mentioned going after the cleric Sadr. I saw a huge difference in sentiment between what we saw in Sadr City, named for his father, last summer, where it was in this strongly Shiite ghetto, really, that was brutalized by Saddam, was the area where we saw the strongest initial support for the coalition's action, the most patience, the most forbearance towards U.S. troops, and that shifted as well in the current poll. So I think had we gone into the field any later, we simply wouldn't have been able to pull it off.
So now, how many surveyors did you have? How many people did they interview?
About 70. We had teams across the country. We did a total of almost 3,500 interviews over those couple of weeks, but 350 separate locations around the country.
In looking through some of the findings, what I find, most painful and is the way in which, despite the overwhelming support for the overthrow of Saddam, the U.S. seems to have just lost so much credibility, whether it's troops or just the political actions. Almost every question you asked Iraqis, across the board, people show great disappointment with the United States performance.
I think disappointment is the word. And in a way, if you think about it, it's telling that they had high expectations, and I think we've really disillusioned with the performance because the expectations were so high. Now, maybe in some areas they were slightly higher than what was realistic, but still there are some other areas, realistic expectations that hadn't been met with regard to security.
Well, give us a couple of key numbers that you think show that.
Well, let's just talk about whether the security situation is getting better or worse. Clearly, people are saying in the last few months it's gotten worse. Attitudes towards the troops. When we interviewed in Baghdad last summer, we had by a 2-to-1 margin, 58% to 29%, people with predominantly a favorable attitude of the conduct of U.S. forces there. That shifted entirely within Baghdad. Now it's 8-to-1 negative. Part of that's a normal process that you go through after you've been as military forces in a country for an extended period of time. You tend to wear out your welcome. And part of it's just images of civilian casualties, discussion of that. Time is not on your side when you're in that role, and especially if you have an ongoing insurgency, and if you could put yourself on the other side of that equation, our forces are under stress, in danger, and so on. They're not necessarily trained for urban situations or for interaction in civil affairs folks and so on. So those are examples of areas where I think that really the goodwill has largely evaporated. Yeah. They still want it to work out, but they think it's going to happen now on their watch and not on ours.
Another thing that you actually asked, can current attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq, you asked them, can you personally justify current attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq? Only a quarter of the sample said cannot justify it at all.
Right. If you take this the starkest category, the attacks on U.S. forces are completely justified, you get 13% of the whole population that say that. That's a daunting number. If you go to the strongly Sunni areas to the north, it jumps to 30%. If you go to Anbar and Saladin, which is where Fallujah, Ramadi, and so on are, it's 62% of the population that were saying, even before this latest outbreak, yes, they're completely justified. You go down to the Shia areas in the south, it's only 8% in Basra and those areas. So it is very, and of course up in the Kurdish north may as well be a different country entirely. Very strongly supportive of the coalition, strongly supportive of the U.S. and so on, just completely different on all attitudinal questions.
Richard Burkholder, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
Richard Burkholder is International Bureau Chief at the Gallup Poll. He spoke with us from Princeton, New Jersey. In Britain, the political classes are preparing to mark a couple of political anniversaries. 25 years ago next week, Margaret Thatcher became Britain's Prime Minister. She led the Conservative Party to 3 election victories in 8 years. Remember that number 8. But by the time of her 3rd victory, she had spent so much time inside the bubble of her own power, she began to lose her previously unfailing understanding of the British public. Eventually, she alienated so many of her own members of Parliament, they deposed her in 1990 in what can only be described as a bloodless coup. 8 years ago next week, I told you to remember the number 8, Tony Blair led Britain's Labour Party to an unprecedented landslide victory over the Conservatives, and on the ground cleared by Margaret Thatcher, began to try and replant some social democratic trees. And I just realized it wasn't 8 years ago, it was 7 years ago. But I apologize, because the point is that 7 years into his premiership, Blair is exhibiting all the same signs of losing touch with people and his own party that Mrs. T did. His unstinting support for President Bush over the war in Iraq was deeply unpopular. More recently, his endorsement of Bush's decision to throw away the Middle East roadmap prompted 52 former senior British diplomats to publish a letter criticizing his unbalanced policies on the Middle East. More than a few British pundits have begun to write Blair's political obituary, calling this allegiance to Bush a tragic flaw. This hour on point, the tragedy of being Tony Blair. A year after the Iraq War, what's your opinion of the British Prime Minister? Are you disappointed in his unfailing support of the U.S.? Did his support of the war actually influence your view on whether going to war was right or not? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Bath in England is Geoffrey Wheatcroft, author of The Tragedy of Tony Blair, which is an article coming out in the June issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Geoffrey. Geoffrey, hello.
Hi.
What prompted you to write this article with such a stark title as The Tragedy of Tony Blair?
Well, it's 7 years since he became Prime Minister in a couple of weeks' time. On Saturday. Almost 10 years since he became leader of the Labour Party. When he became Prime Minister, there was an enormous mood of elation in the country. I mean, I think looking back on it, to some extent that was illusory, because really people were more keen to have got rid of the previous Conservative government after 18 years than they were happy to have a new government. But nevertheless, there was a spring in the step of the whole British people. And Blair appeared to promise a great deal of a fresh approach, youthful vigor even on his own part. And there is now an overwhelming feeling right across the political spectrum. I'm obviously trying not to be partisan in any way, that his promise has been unfulfilled, and that I quoted a most eminent and much admired and much loved political journalist, Hugo Young, who died far too young last fall, and who had been a deep admirer of Blair's at the beginning, and who wrote not long before he died that instead of this great man he had hoped for, there now stood on the stage a great tragic figure whose career was really wasted.
Wasted because he had...
Well, wasted because in terms of domestic politics, Blair has come to much less than his admirers had hoped for in all sorts of ways. I mean, his achievements have not been anything like as distinctive as he had promised. But really, above all, because his entire political career has turned into being a prime minister who has made war over and again in a way that he never gave an intimation of before he became prime minister, and finally culminating in the Iraq War, when he was determined to lead the country into the war, when he gave uncritical support to President Bush.
Jeffrey?
And a war which, it must be remembered, this is the great distinction between England and America. Most British people did not want it and never have.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, and I'd like to bring into the conversation Pippa Norris, who's here with me in the studio. Pippa is a professor of comparative politics at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Pippa, how do you see the Tony Blair today in this situation with his support ebbing? Do you see him as a tragic figure?
Well, I understand why Jeffrey says that many are disillusioned, because there was such excitement when he came in for the first time to number 10. The flags were waving. Everybody thought it was a new dawn. And there are other problems. Dissent in the ranks in the parliament, slipping popularity, problems over Iraq, and the problems in particular of losing support amongst his heartland. But against that, think about the economy. Britain is doing far, far better than most of Europe in terms of inflation, jobs and growth. In terms of, he's still facing a very weak opposition, so he can still go on for many, many years. And the Conservatives, despite everything, haven't really improved since the last election. He's very comfortable in the polls. He's gone down a bit, but it's the midterm. And in terms of his personality, we have to say we shouldn't dismiss him. Many people have already written his obituary, but that's happened lots of times. He is the great persuader.
Jeffrey, when we study Shakespeare at school, we associate the word tragedy with death, the end. Do you think that Blair is approaching an end?
Well, no, because I agree with much of what Pip has just said. I mean, since I signed off the piece in the Atlantic the other week and it went to press, things have simply got much worse than I almost foresaw earlier in April. For Blair, he's had this, what was frankly a humiliation at President Bush's hands when he went to Washington in the footsteps of Ariel Sharon, who had cut a deal with Bush, which was a complete repudiation of everything that Blair had said previously he stood for. He had insisted that he didn't want a referendum on the European Constitution and that he would resist having one, not least because he thought he would lose it. But he then did the most spectacular about turn and has agreed to hold a referendum, though postponing it as long as he can.
But Jeffrey, the word is tragedy, which is an emotive one.
It seems tragic because over and again he is denying everything he had previously said. And in the last two or three weeks, there has been, despite what Pippa says, there has been possibly too much of a change of mood. One should never read too much into what we call the commentariat says. But, I mean, I can count a dozen pieces, published newspaper pieces, in the last 2 weeks saying that Tony Blair's days are numbered, or his reign is finished, or the Blair age is over, even though it is more than possible that he will, in fact, go on to the next election, and more than possible that he'll win it. There is a very strong feeling, which I think it is, which I certainly share myself, that despite paradoxically the fact that it is, and this is absolutely true, that the economy is doing very well, and that's probably why he will win the next election, and yet his
leadership
has been empty of achievement.
Jeffrey, the music means that we're coming to the end of the segment. Listeners, we're talking in this hour about the tragedy of Tony Blair. Is it indeed a tragedy? How important to you is Tony Blair's support for the U.S. policy in Iraq right now? Did you think Tony Blair misled the British public? Did he mislead you over the weapons of mass destruction issue? Join us by calling 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour about Tony Blair. The conversation is prompted by a whole bunch of things that are happening back in Britain. Recent opinion polls show him with a minus 20 points personal approval rating. The British people are rather solidly against the war and by the day turning against it further. 52 of the most senior British diplomats recently wrote a letter to him, published it, unheard of, really, to make clear their displeasure with his standing so close to President Bush, particularly on matters related to Israel and Palestine. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to join in the conversation. I'm talking with Jeffrey Wheatcroft, whose article, The Tragedy of Tony Blair, appears in the June issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and to spark this conversation, Pippa Norris is with me in the studio. She's a professor of comparative politics at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And I'm going to bring into the conversation now Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, who's in Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Michael, and a fond hello to Jeffrey. Thanks for staying up.
Hi, Jack.
Now, Jack... As an observer of politicians for a very long time, you look at Tony Blair and you feel that the place he's worked himself to today as we speak is a tragic one?
Well, you know, the picture that Jeffrey draws that I connect with and that makes him seem tragic in the noble sense is that this is a man who misrepresented his way into a war basically to save the United States from blowing up the international system, that he went to war less to dethrone Saddam than to contain Bush, that the thought of America going and fighting alone, acting unilaterally without any company, would simply break the whole foundations of international law and the structures of peace that America and Britain and its allies had built since the Second War. And this picture that Jeffrey draws and others have drawn is that Blair simply said, well, that we can't let the Americans do this alone, and we're going to get into this.
Now, what Blair would say back to you, Jack, is that he was well aware of the potential dangers of leaving Saddam Hussein in place and had been, you know, in the 90s when the second Bush presidency was just a fond dream in Kennebunkport, Maine. Now, if that's the case, then perhaps he had his own interest in going to war because he felt that it was the right thing to do. Jeffrey, do you think that that's a possibility?
That's what he says, and he does now say, he still says, it was the right thing to do, which is a phrase we have heard from his lips rather repetitiously. It doesn't make sense chronologically. I mean, I want to look at this in the most detached possible spirit. When, of all the strange things that Mr. Blair said between September 2002, when he began his political campaign, really on behalf of President Bush, to get Great Britain into the war with the Americans, and then when the war began in a year ago, he, among the strange things he said, I think the strangest was that I would support this war even if the Americans were opposed to it. Now, to begin with, that is frankly absurd. You know, I mean, there are certain statements which are so obviously ludicrous that you have to pinch yourself not to laugh. But secondly, why had he not done so? I mean, he'd had plenty of opportunity. Blair became prime minister only 3 months after Bill Clinton's second inauguration. And there is no evidence, and that's to say 3 3/4 years before George Bush became president. There was no evidence, in other words.
Jeffrey, to be fair, in that period of time, he and Bill Clinton went to war in Kosovo.
Which, yes.
And there were a variety of other international crises that he was dealing with.
That's true.
So, and one of the interesting things, I mean, you can certainly, Blair made some very absurd comments in the run-up to the war as he desperately tried to convince people. But they did make war, they worked together, and there's no doubt about it that there was contact and constant discussion about what to do about Saddam. And I dare say that they were worried about the nexus of Saddam and al-Qaeda.
What is also true is Blair was conscious of the danger of what we have to call weapons of mass destruction in Saddam's hands from the time he became prime minister in May of 1997. And there is contemporary evidence that he was talking about that to to people in private at that time. Nevertheless, it still doesn't make sense. It doesn't parse. If you look at it chronologically, if the raison d'etre for the war was weapons of mass destruction, then the reason for going to war was much stronger in 97 or 98 than it was a year ago, because, as we now know, he had no weaponizable WMD at that time, and so forth. And so Blair's, it is perfectly clear, I think, in a completely objective way, that Blair, whereas on the one hand, George Bush and his colleagues decided to go to war with Saddam because they wanted to go to war with Saddam, because they wanted to destroy Saddam, for which there might have been a good case, but that was not Tony Blair's case. Blair's underlying justification to himself, though perhaps not quite so publicly, was that he must support the Americans for the reasons that you were just saying. This, to my view, rather strange logic that the world would be more dangerous if the Americans were seen to be acting alone than if they had other people's support.
Pippa, how has this prevarication, these various backpedalings on the reason for the war, affected Blair's popularity? You study the British electorate fairly thoroughly.
Yes, they have, clearly. If you look at the popularity just before the war occurred, Blair was really around 25%. He then had a short rally around the flag effect, about 10% he went up, and then he went down immediately. But in a sense, when we talk about this as a tragedy for Blair, in some ways it's actually more of a tragedy for British foreign policy. If there had been another leader in his place, for example, if Michael Howard had been the Prime Minister instead of
Michael
Blair...
Michael Howard is the leader of the Conservative Party at the moment.
Yes. Would there have been a different policy? And I think not. It's essentially the Iraq tragedy is one where Britain is always trying to act as the transatlantic bridge between Europe and the United States, between the United States and also the UN. And it was that which failed, that which fell apart. And so, in a sense, Blair followed the traditional foreign policy position. But in this particular case, for a variety of reasons, it proved a disaster.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Gabe is on the line from Boston.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I remember so vividly after 9/11, when Tony Blair published, I think it was one or 2 days after that horrible day, published an open letter to Americans and to the world. And I remember at that point being so comforted by his tone of incredible balance and a kind of elegance of world perspective that, frankly, I wished our leaders had at that moment, this kind of havoc in this country. I have been unable since then to kind of reconcile that sense of Blair with what then became a very unbalanced kind of monolithic posture, which he adopted much closer to the kind of out-of-touch reality of our President Bush. And I was just wondering if your guest would offer some sense of what happened to that man.
Jeffrey, do you have any sense from reporting and talking to people who actually are close to him whether there was a turning point when he seemed to retreat to a place where nobody could reach him?
Well, there was no precise turning point, but, I mean, first of all, I entirely agree that, I mean, I think everybody here felt, no, that's not true. There was the cranky far left, the America Had It Coming brigade, if you know what I mean, who reacted to 9/11 in the most horrific and spiteful way by saying that it was the fault of the Americans for having 3,000 people murdered. And Tony Blair not only quite rightly offered complete British support for the Americans at that moment, he also quite rightly rebuked those who had expressed that kind of venomous anti-American hatred. But just as the huge wave of support and affection throughout the world for America after September 11 has, without question, been dissipated, one has to say, thanks to the actions of the Bush administration, so has Tony Blair's own position dwindled away because, you know, he said, we are going to support the Americans through thick and thin after this atrocious event in September 2001. And most people, I speak for myself, but I think I speak probably for most British people as well felt, yeah, we are with the Americans in this. But what we didn't know at that moment was that we were going to be with them in a war on Iraq, and we didn't realize we had signed up for that.
I'm not sure that most Americans at the time that we made war on Afghanistan realized for sure that we'd be making war in Iraq. But Jack Beattie, when did you notice a change? I mean, presumably you were thoroughly impressed when Blair was elected, and as you've watched him speak, you must have felt the same envy we all feel to have so articulate a person as the leader, political leader of a country.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, he helped to not only legitimize but etherealize Bush's war. I mean, when he talked about it, it was about, well, not just weapons, not just getting rid of a dictator, but, you know, finally addressing the problem of democracy in the Arab world, finally, you know, taking a stand toward a wider idea of justice than simply serving our interests out of getting oil out of the Middle East. And one listened to him and one found one's head nodding and then had to slap oneself to say, oh, by God, look what I'm nodding to. But, you know, Gabe put his finger on something many people felt here, that he was at the Congress. He happened to be in Washington, I guess. I don't know. He was there when Bush made his address to the nation. And to see him up there, I heard more people say they felt so comforted to know that Britain was with us. And he had a nimbus, he had a status here, and Jeffrey throws out, I think, what is a very useful conjecture. This might have been the only man who could have stopped the march to war. That is, his sway with the American public was such, partly just because he could speak literately, partly because he always impressed the Americans, but also because he was a British prime minister, that if he had spoken truth to power, what might have happened? For example, would it have given Colin Powell, given him a spark of courage to stand out? Who knows?
Well, I think that the record shows that Powell and Blair spoke frequently in August of 2002, and basically they were trying to work out a strategy that would slow the rush, get it to the UN. And it was Powell and Blair actually talking, Jack. That's pretty well documented now. But what I'd like to do now is bring into the conversation Paul Richards, who is also in England and joined the Labour Party in 1986 and has worked on a variety of Labour causes and has a new book out called Tony Blair in His Own Words. Hello, Paul.
Hello there.
I apologize for the line. Sometimes the transatlantic wires don't work too well. You've been listening to the conversation. What do you make of it? You obviously are still a Blair supporter.
Well, I am. I think that's an important part of context that needs to be remembered. Firstly, Blair is actually doing very well as leader of the country. The Labour Party is ahead in most of the opinion polls. The economy is performing exceptionally well. There are a million more people in work in the UK than there were. We've introduced the national minimum wage. And these kind of underlying bread and butter issues are what determine elections. And Blair still has an enormous parliamentary majority. So there's a lot of wishful thinking, I think, on the part of people that are writing his political obituaries. But it's not borne out by the political realities. Obviously, a 10-year anniversary, it is now 10 years as he has been leader of the Labour Party, it gives people that opportunity. It's a good news peg. But it's not actually borne out by the underlying politics and underlying economics of what's happening in the UK.
Well, Paul, I mean, do you get the sense that the party itself is prepared to stay with him as he continues, particularly in the foreign affairs arena, to go against the gut instincts of the parliamentary Labour Party and the broader party, the grassroots?
Well, the Parliamentary Labour Party supported the action in Iraq, remember. There's always a...
But the more recent... I'm referring specifically to his recent appearance on the White House lawn with President Bush just after the president had endorsed Ariel Sharon's unilateral policy to withdraw from Gaza and so on, kind of tearing up the roadmap. And I think a lot of people were upset about that.
Yes, a lot of people were upset about them, but not a majority. Not a majority that could form an opposition to Blair either inside the Labour Party or beyond it that would get rid of him. This is the key point. He still has a majority of support inside the Labour Party, inside the parliamentary Labour Party, and if opinion polls are to be believed, with the public at large. The interesting point about the diplomats that wrote their letter complaining about the tearing up of the roadmap and so on, I mean, what that was a reflection of the incredibly pro-Arab sentiment inside the diplomatic corps and the Foreign Office in the UK. And you could have found 40 or 50 other diplomats who had taken the opposite line. But it's a reflection of a sort of interesting British cultural point rather than a serious opposition to Blair. And don't forget, these diplomats represented an incredibly narrow strata of British society. They go to public schools, which of course means private schools in the UK. 12 of them went to Oxford, 13 of them went to Cambridge. They all belong to the same London clubs and so on. And they are not representative of British public opinion.
Geoffrey Wheatcroft, is that true? Are we making too much of this letter?
No, I think we are. I mean, everything that has just been said is to some extent true, and it is perfectly, of course, the case that the Foreign Office does have a long Arabist tradition. Nevertheless, when the 52 former ambassadors said that Tony Blair's policy in Iraq was not going well, it's impossible to contradict them. And when they said in particular that it seems that there was no serious strategy for post-Saddam Iraq, it's completely impossible to contradict them. I mean, their letter was actually quite cogent, and I think it expressed the views of many people who take any interest in the subject. As to the question, there is a paradox here. I mean, I've said already that Blair's probably going to win the next election, and it is absolutely true that thanks to a thoroughly moderate and conservative conduct of the economy, the British economy is in extremely good shape at the moment. Unemployment, inflation, and interest rates are all together at record lows. Most people are distinctly better off and better paid in real terms than they were 7 years ago. And yet, to say that this means that Blair has been a success really isn't true. Even to say that he's enjoys the support of the Parliamentary Labour Party isn't true. I mean, a year ago, or a bit more than a year ago, in the crucial Iraq debate, 139 Labour MPs voted against Blair, which is the largest rebellion of any government party since the Home Rule crisis in 1886.
Geoffrey, I'm going to have to interrupt you. The music means that we're coming up to the break. Paul, I want to thank you for joining us briefly. I'm sorry about the quality of the phone line. Paul Richards is the author of Tony Blair in His Own Words. Connection listeners, we're talking about Tony Blair in this hour. Question to think about for after the break. Is there a natural shelf life for political leaders? In America, you get 2 terms in office as president. That's 8 years. And we start talking of them as being lame ducks at year 6. Is there just a natural shelf life, and has Blair reached the end of his? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Tony Blair. I was asking just before the break, is there a natural shelf life for a prime minister or a president? Does America have it right with its 2-term limit? You get sick of them after 6-7 years. Let them be lame ducks and go away. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Graham is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts.
Good evening.
Hello, Graham.
Thanks for taking the call. I am a Brit, and I return to the UK tomorrow. I'll be back again in the States on business a couple of weeks later. I was one of those who read in detail the so-called September dossier, September 2002, which was published by the British government. If you recall, at the time, the amount of fact which was in the public domain was somewhat limited. So I digested that document quite thoroughly, and as a result, I was convinced, to a certain extent, in spite of my earlier concerns, that going to war with Iraq was the right thing to do, with the objective of removing Saddam. I was particularly swayed by arguments in that document referring to the ability to deploy weapons of mass destruction within 45 minutes and so on and so forth. Subsequently, further investigation and all the data that have come to light lead me to believe that I was, whether deliberately or inadvertently, well and truly misled.
Well and truly. And is that going to affect the way you vote next time?
It is, absolutely. It's not an isolated situation, may I say, notwithstanding the comments of the gentleman who's writing a book about Tony Blair shortly. In my opinion, there have been a number of failures on the part of the two Labour administrations which Tony Blair has led. And they have, to one degree or another, an association with what we call spin, the slight distortion of facts in an almost propagandist way.
Well, they call it presentation.
Alone, yeah. I will vote for the opposition next time round.
Graham, thank you very much for your call. There's one dissatisfied voter, and I'm wondering, Jack Beattie, do you think that there is a natural shelf life for a national leader?
Well, in America, the second term has been a curse for our presidents. Franklin Roosevelt really was saved by the bell, saved by his third term. But if his presidency had ended in his second, we'd remember him for his disastrous attempt to pack the Supreme Court. Ronald Reagan with Iran-Contra, Bill Clinton with any number of scandals in his second term. You know, it's when they don't have to face the voters again. There's no constraint. And the impulse is to just get it done, you know, no matter what the law. And presidents again and again have just fallen foul of that second term. So my argument would be, let's have them for one term.
Yeah, but my question really, Jack, is do people who spend, by the time they get to the six-year mark of being the supreme power, more or less, in their countries, do they lose the natural antennae that they have when they're coming up and they need to really respond and be alert to public opinion, what the public wants? And then after they get that second election under their belt, it doesn't matter anymore.
Well, I think you're right about that. I call that the Xanadu effect, you know, as in Kublai Khan and Xanadu, a stately pleasure dome. They're in that pleasure dome. And it just, yes, I mean, auto-suggestion, the sycophancy, you know, I'm posing for the history books, complete. I mean, just simply spending 6 years in the bubble, that's the word we use, you don't get you don't get any connection with what's outside. Jimmy Carter tried to break that in his first term by traveling around the country and staying with ordinary families and so on. Unfortunately, it didn't do him any good politically.
Pippa, what do you think? Is there a measurable effect since you measure these things?
Well, I think that some of those things are true. But when I look at this Labour government in particular and when I talk to people there, what strikes me is how strong they are in some ways, such as their majority, but how constantly aware they are of the public, how always they're taking public opinion polls, and they're very, very sensitive. Their biggest fear, it seems to me, is that they think they are actually achieving things on public services, on health, on education, on transport. They just don't think that the public is getting it. They don't think their message is getting through, and they're communicating this. So despite the fact that under most predictions they're going to win the next election, they just don't quite believe it, and they're therefore really insecure, despite having been in power for so long.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Isaac is calling from Boston.
Hello.
Isaac.
Hi, good evening. Just one point I'd like to make. I've listened to your show quite often, and normally there's quite a few things I disagree with. Sometimes your news is very slanted, and in this case I think it's very biased against Tony Blair. And there's been a lot of Blair bashing going on this evening. Now, you've got to look at his entire record. He's not a warmonger, by no means. If you look at what he's done in Ireland, only for Tony Blair there would not be peace in the Republic of Ireland today. Now, I think that speaks for itself and speaks volumes. I'm Irish. I have never approved of any Prime Minister in England bar Tony Blair.
Right. So
and it's also pretty hilarious, the fact that Tony Blair is actually Labour and Bush is Republican, which is the opposite. They're diametrically opposed to each other. It's almost like having Margaret Thatcher on one side and, you know, Teddy Kennedy on the other side.
What do you suspect is the reason for their close friendship then?
I believe that Tony Blair is a really good and just and upright person, and he made the best judgment based on the facts that were presented to him.
Isaac, thank you for your call. I'm going to put something to Jeffrey Wheatcroft. Now, the Good Friday Agreement remains a real landmark, even if sometimes it seems that Northern Ireland politicians are backsliding. Jeffrey, you are quite critical of Tony Blair in your article. I mean, will you grant him at least that as a major accomplishment, and perhaps that encouraged him to try other things on the world stage?
I'm not as enthusiastic about the Good Friday Agreement as some people are. I mean, in any case, at the moment, it was based on this very Tony Blair-like. I will agree that it was highly characteristic of Mr. Blair because it was based on his one of his most genuine, sincere beliefs that people are all have common interests which they are merely unable through blindness to perceive. That's to say, you know, if only the Israelis and the Palestinians could see they have a common interest, they could make peace with each other. If only the Protestant Unionists and the Catholic Republicans in Northern Ireland could see that they... Well, the trouble is, in the case of the Good Friday Agreement, it was... I hope not a cynic, but certainly a skeptic about it 6 years ago, because it was based on telling two different parties completely opposite things, and that's why at the moment the whole thing is in abeyance. But I'd like to go back to this question of the caller who said that he was convinced by the dossier. Because I am not sympathetic to people who say that. That's to say, I know that many people were persuaded by
Jeffrey. I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you. We have 52 seconds left in this segment, and I want to ask you a simple question because you started this conversation. You acknowledge that Blair is likely to be reelected. Is there any room for redemption so that you might write about him someday and say he isn't a tragic figure? Simple answer.
Yes, of course there is. There is always room for all of us for redemption, but I don't see it in the immediate future. I mean, I think that he is at the moment so locked into policies which his own party and most British people don't support that, though paradoxically he will probably win the next election, that is the tragedy.
Jeffrey Wheatcroft, thank you very much for joining us. Pippa Norris, thank you for being with me in the studio. Jack Beattie, as always, thank you for sharing your thoughts on politics out there in Hanover, New Hampshire. And you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. And in a moment, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jane Smiley shares her passion for horse racing. This is On Point. Horse racing's biggest weekend of the year kicks off tomorrow in Louisville, Kentucky, with the 130th running of the $500,000 Kentucky Oaks. It culminates Saturday with the Sport of Kings' most prestigious race, the $1 Million Kentucky Derby. One thoroughbred owner who will not be saddling up a horse in Saturday's Derby is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley. But the author of Horse Heaven will be watching. And like thousands of other owners, she will be dreaming of the day when one of her horses parades beneath the twin spires of Churchill Downs on Derby Day. Smiley's latest book, A Year at the Races, chronicles a year's worth of ups and downs as a thoroughbred owner. In this radio diary, she reads a passage from her book and explains why she has fallen in love with horses.
Horses have a lot of personality, and they also have a lot of emotional affect. But their faces are not shaped like ours in any way, and so it's hard to detect their emotions with the habits that we've developed for detecting the emotions of other people. A lot of their emotions are in their bodies. They kick up, or they rear up, or they run around, or they leap into the air, or they sigh. And to me, that's very fascinating that they have such evident emotional lives. They have strong attachments to one another. They can have strong attachments to the people if the people will elicit them. The great thing about a horse is, compared to a dog, say, is that a dog is kind of programmed to become attached to his human, and a horse isn't. A horse can live with you for 20 years in total indifference. So when you do have a horse who has an emotional attachment to you, it's very flattering because he didn't have to do that. Jackie is my favorite of the horses. He's the oldest. I call him my firstborn. He is now 7. And when he was a month old, and before I really knew anything about foals, I was just sort of going along with whatever I was told. His mother called his dam. She'd colicked and died, and he was orphaned. And I adored him. I just couldn't get enough of him. He was very friendly and very pretty and sweet. So I would go to where he was about twice a week, and I would just pet him from ears to tail. And he became very friendly toward me, and he stayed that way. We had a good relationship. So then he went off to the training farm, and I didn't see him for about 6 months. So finally I went down to the training farm, and I was walking along, and his stall was kind of behind a screen, and I shouted out, "Oh, Jackie boy, Jackie boy," and I came around the screen, and he had charged from the back of his stall to the front. He nearly slammed open the door with his chest, and he began snuffling my face and my mouth in a very eager way. I've never had a horse be so happy to see me, and, you know, he just couldn't get enough of me. And likewise, I couldn't get enough of him. The book is about a horse, or two horses, actually, that I had at the racetrack. They both started out at Santa Anita, and the older one, the gelding, or he was a colt at the time, ended up at Bay Meadows. It took him a long time to break his maiden. That means it took him a long time to win his first race, which was sort of agonizing to me. But one day in early June, I picked my sister and her two sons up at their house in Palo Alto, and we went to the racetrack. And this is about that day. Up in the turf club, we stood by the window and watched the doors of the third hole. As they opened, Wowie seemed to rise up and charge forth, leaping to the front as if he couldn't get there fast enough. But the younger horse, Ship Ahoy, broke even better and went out ahead. For a while, Wowie was at his side, and then he dropped back. By the half, Wowie had gained all the ground he'd lost and was only a head behind. Seconds later, he pulled in front and just kept going, striding, running without apparent effort. As he entered the home stretch from the turn, he left the other horses behind and galloped for the finish line, which he crossed alone by 3 lengths, never seeming to let up, even though no horses were threatening him. We were yelling and jumping up and down, shouting, "He won! He won!" And my son turned and looked me in the face, puckered up, and gave me a big smacker right on the lip, the perfect expression of family solidarity and betting success. We stood there until the trainer said, "Want to go down to the winner's circle?" That's when I thought I was going to faint. I guess I was more surprised than I realized.
Jane Smiley is a thoroughbred owner and author of the new book, A Year at the Races, Reflections on Horses, Humans, Love, Money, and Luck. For the record, she has her money on Tappet and Borrego in Saturday's Derby. I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.